This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
If you think you've had a fabulous dinner party, wait till you hear about the one that happened on April 29th, 1962. It's the subject of a new book called Dinner in Camelot. Joseph Esposito is the author. Welcome, Joseph. Good morning.
Good morning, Sue. Great to be with you.
And happy birthday to your book.
Well, thank you. Today's the release date. And by the way, I should say that I'm a native of northeastern Pennsylvania. I grew up in Hazleton.
Did you know? Tell us a little bit about your upbringing then, because this is something I didn't know, but I'm fascinated. So tell us about yourself.
Well, one thing I can tell you is that I met John Kennedy in Hazleton on October 28, 1960. He was campaigning in northeastern and southeastern Pennsylvania. He later spoke in Wilkes-Barre. And I had an opportunity to speak with him in Hazleton, got his autograph on the cover of a Saturday Evening Post with a drawing done of him by Norman Rockwell. And that sparked an interest, a lifelong interest, really, in politics, history, and government. And I went on to serve in 3 presidential administrations.
Oh, so good to have a native son back on our airwaves with us on WILK to talk about your book. And I know when we have people over to the house, Joseph, sometimes we sweat it trying to pick out who's good to come over, who gets along with who, and maybe some rabble-rousers. And on April 29th, 1962, it was quite the assembly there at the White House for dinner, right?
It was 175 guests. It was the largest dinner of the Kennedy era, and it was really an unbelievable galaxy of geniuses, 49 Nobel Prize winners. And even those people who weren't Nobel Prize winners were very distinguished in their fields. Among those who weren't Nobel Prize winners were Robert Frost, William Styron, James Baldwin, Catherine Ann Porter, John Dos Passos. Ernest Hemingway's widow was there, sat next to President Kennedy, and the principal after-dinner literary presentation was an unpublished manuscript written by Hemingway, who had died the year before. There were some contentious relationships, but many of these people had known one another for years, had worked with one another. Several had worked on the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos. The preponderance of people were scientists, but there were the literary people. There were two Nobel Peace Prize winners as well. But the list of distinguished people just goes on and on. Robert Oppenheimer, Pearl Buck, Linus Pauling. And the Linus Pauling connection is really quite interesting because he had won the Nobel Prize in 1954 and had become a significant peace activist, and he was invited to the dinner because he had won the Nobel Prize, but he was out picketing the White House that same day and the previous day as well, because he was unhappy that President Kennedy was getting nowhere on a measure to limit nuclear testing. So he was picketing outside the White House and went over to the Willard Hotel across the street from the White House to change into his tuxedo and went into dinner. And in the receiving line, President Kennedy said, well, you've been around the White House a few days already, haven't you? And then before he introduced Pauling to Mrs. Kennedy, he said, I hope that you will continue to express your opinions. And Pauling had a great time. He actually led this spur-of-the-moment impromptu dancing in the hall.
It's amazing to think, Joseph, that there wouldn't be some kind of trepidation about that with those who protected the president, knowing that somebody who expressed open dissent was being allowed in.
Well, it was a different time, of course. And I had the opportunity to speak to several people associated with the dinner, including Clint Hill, who was Jackie Kennedy's Secret Service agent, and he discussed the measures that they took, which were rather lax, certainly by today's standards. In fact, the writer James Baldwin, when he went was going into the dinner, he was outside at the little guardhouse there at the southwest gate of the White House, and he forgot his invitation, and he also forgot his wallet. So the guard there said, "Is there any possibility you might have your name in your jacket?" And Baldwin opens his jacket and says, "James Baldwin." He said, "Well, that's fine. You can just go right in."
These were different times indeed, for sure.
They were. They were.
What was the occasion that brought all these people together? What kind of mailing did they get, or why were they invited? What was going on at the White House?
Well, at the very outset of the Kennedy administration, it had been decided that they wanted to make an overture to people in the arts and to the broader intellectual community. And so at the inauguration in January 1961, there was a large representation from people in the literary community, the artistic community. And there were a number of dinners and presentations at the White House that preceded this dinner. Pablo Casals, for instance, the cellist, the great cellist, had performed earlier at the White House. And as an interesting side story here, he had last performed for Theodore Roosevelt at the White House. So 60 years later, he comes back and performs during the Kennedy era. But it had been decided that it was a desirable opportunity to invite the Nobel Prize winners. Primarily, these people were scientists. The overwhelming majority of these Nobel Prize winners were scientists. There were Nobel Prize winners in peace and Prolbuck in literature, but they were scientists, and someone worked on the Manhattan Project, and John Glenn was there as well. Of course, he wasn't a Nobel Prize winner, but it was an overture to the scientific community and to really thank them for their accomplishments. This was the height of the Cold War, and also really the height of, in many ways, of American scientific achievement. And it was a time when we had people from the Manhattan Project and people who were like John Glenn, who were involved in the very early stages of the space race as well.
Was there a special way that the seating was devised? I mean, I think about trying to do that under normal circumstances and try to get people together. But did they try to put an artist with a scientist, or what was the rhyme or reason to it?
Well, it was very carefully calibrated, and the First Lady Jackie Kennedy certainly had a role in that, and the principal. A responsibility, though, was by Tish Baldrige, who was the social secretary. And they had tables, round tables of 10 people each, and there were two rooms that were used. There was the state dining room where the president essentially presided, and he had what would be considered perhaps the main table where Robert Frost sat, and Mrs. George Marshall, and Mrs. Ernest Hemingway sat, and several others. And then, because it was so large, they had to use another room. And so the Blue Room was employed, and Mrs. Kennedy was there, and she had it was in effect the head table for that room, and John Glenn was there, and Pearl Buck, and Lester Pearson, who the following year became Prime Minister of Canada, was seated there as well. So they had a public address system, and when President Kennedy spoke, people in both rooms could hear him. After the dinner, they had a bit of a reception, and then they had an entertainment discussion, literary discussion of works by Hemingway, but also Sinclair Lewis, and the Harvard commencement speech by George Marshall, which laid out the Marshall Plan. And I also talk in the book about this after party that was held in the private quarters for a select dozen people in the second floor at the Yellow Oval Room, in which people like William Styron was there and Robert Frost and others.
Just an extraordinary time, and I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask about the menu, wouldn't I? Because I know a lot of people are foodies in this day and age. So what was considered on that? Did you get a choice on the card, or what happened there?
Well, no. There was... The White House brought in a rather notable French chef at the outset. It was someone was selected by Jackie Kennedy, and he was a very particular chef, and they would sit down and devise what the menu would be for each of these big dinners. Interestingly, when they were having discussions about the dinner and the chef, the executive chef was present, the social secretary would constantly refer to the dinner as the brains dinner because these people were so intelligent. And he misunderstood and thought that they were going to serve brains for dinner. And he protested, said that brains was just not appropriate. As it turns out, the main course was beef Wellington, and in the book I actually have a reproduction of the dinner menu.
And how many? I guess because you have your White House photographer there and so on and so forth. How many photographs exist, and what strikes you about some of them?
Well, many photographs exist at the Kennedy Library in Boston, and that was very useful for me. I have about 30 photos in the book. Life magazine, which was certainly prominent at the time, had a number of additional photographs as well. I think what would strike people would be the sense of gaiety of the evening. These were extremely intelligent, accomplished people who really enjoyed themselves. And Linus Pauling, even though he had been picketing the White House, led this impromptu dancing, and there's some photographs of that as well, which is quite fascinating.
And what's your relationship like with Rose Styron, the widow of William Styron, and she wrote in your book the foreword, right? So what is their place with you and with the Kennedys?
Well, Rose Styron was very gracious, and we had a long interview in which she discussed her memories of the dinner. It was very helpful, and as you note, she wrote the foreword, which I'm very grateful for. William Styron, who wrote Sophie's Choice and The Confessions of Nat Turner and other notable works, had never met John Kennedy, and they formed a friendship at that dinner in the after party, actually. In the residence, and the relationship between the Kennedys and the Styrons, not just John Kennedy, but Jackie Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Ted Kennedy and others, has continued for more than 50 years, and it was a result of that dinner.
Interesting. Joseph Esposito, native of Hazleton, who went on to work in a couple of different administrations and was intrigued enough to write a book about what must have been an absolutely amazing dinner party. I would be so nervous at this. It would be unbelievable for me. But the book is called Dinner in Camelot. To your knowledge, has there been a social event quite this intriguing since then?
No, not at all.
Okay.
There have been some notable dinners, but nothing of this stature. I mean, when you think about 49 Nobel Prize winners, the greatest intellects of the time being honored, and I think what most people know about this dinner, if they have heard about it before, is a quote that President Kennedy gave as part of his remarks. He said, "I think this is the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge that has ever been gathered together at the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone."
Wow. that's some saying. If you could, Joseph, say that you could have people over to your house for a dinner, and they could be from any part of history, have you thought about who you might have over?
Well, I'm a historian, so that's a challenging question for me. I would certainly be interested in talking to Franklin Roosevelt and talking about the great challenges that he faced with the Great Depression and World War II. Surely some of the people who were at this dinner would be those I'd be interested in talking to as well. It's an interesting idea to come up with which people you would be most fascinated with at a dinner party.
Absolutely. And thanks for doing the show today. It was an extra added bonus that you are one of us, and we appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.